ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
As America marks 250 years of independence from Britain, join me, Nick Bryant, for an exploration of the country's origin story and what's happened since.
This is the beginning of the time when human beings were no longer subjects, but citizens.
From the Declaration of Independence to the presidency of Donald Trump, join me for our America 250 series on Saturday Extra. Search for Saturday Extra on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are setting off on the second chapter of a pretty extraordinary journey on this episode, Jerry.
Yes, roaming slightly further than we usually do, that's for sure.
You may have caught the first episode of our conversation with one of the world's great living explorers. His name is Terry Garcia.
And look, I can't wait to go even further and deeper, literally, on this adventure. Through time, through space, through the oceans, through ethics. I'm Geraldine Doogue.
I'm Hamish McDonald. Let's go roaming. Well, look, Geraldine, the first part of the conversation just provoked so many more questions for me. It's rare that you're sitting with someone and, you know, you've got your plan for an interview and you're thinking the whole time, oh, but what about this and what about that and what about space?
And then he delivers. You go there. You know, I said to you, it was a bit like speaking to Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the late Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, where he just kept going deeper and deeper and he kept delivering, and so did Terry Garcia.
Yeah, and so this next chapter is going to go into space. We're going to be talking about the likes of Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and whether these are responsible, I suppose, guardians of scientific research and exploration because, you know, as we've said before, exploration has come with its downsides. It has often preserved things, as you've pointed out, but it's also often alerted humans to the presence of resources or boundaries that they might want to draw. And that can lead to all sorts of things. Commercial extraction, it could lead to conflict over who owns or has the right to access
something. Well, massively, that last part of it, I mean, it has become quite politicised in the last few.
What specifically?
Especially dealing with other First Peoples, often exploration into First Peoples. I mean, look, it's been extraordinary in Australia, that whole business of whether you reburied things down in, you know, in Mungo, man and woman. I mean, that's been immensely complicated, whether you knew that you could access things again or whether you couldn't necessarily be sure. Honestly, that is such a dilemma about human knowledge gathering and whether modern human knowledge gathering is done in the same way that First Peoples want to undertake it.
And in fact, on this second episode of our conversation with Terry Garcia, we are going to get into the ethics of exploration and really, I guess, interrogate what nations like Australia could or should be doing when it comes to this, because terrible things have happened, like the Juukan Gorge, like most recently where there's a renewable energy project in New South Wales that has literally bulldozed over an ancient rock shelter that was so important to the Wiradjuri people. Sometimes you discover these things have happened once they're done and once they're gone. So how do you contend with that? It's not just a matter of bringing back artefacts. Sometimes they are destroyed in full knowledge of their significance.
And look, in the field of archaeology, this is there's a lot of agony about this as to whether, in fact, there is a subtle drawing back, even though our guest Terry Garcia is so completely committed to research and exploration, as he calls it, in a whole lot of areas. You know, a lot of the archaeologists on the Nullarbor Plain, for instance, feel they are not having been given access to caves, for instance, with all sorts of marvellous artefacts because local people say they don't want this to happen. And it really forces you to examine what you think ought to be just without doubt, you know, without debate, that this advance of human knowledge in archaeology ought to be just no holds barred. And there are groups of people coming and saying, no, sorry, we think there should be.
And I suppose this goes to the point that Terry was making in our first episode. If you've missed it, do go and listen to it. You know, he's making a point about how technology might enable different peoples, different cohorts to re-examine their own history because so much of it has been produced produced and delivered through a Western lens. So we're going to get into that, the ethics of it in this episode, but also the conversation about space and where we go, how we do it, whether the rules for exploration that have existed here on Earth, in our oceans as well, whether the game is the same when it comes to outer space. That's all coming up. Let's get stuck into the next chapter of our conversation with Terry Garcia. Geraldine, do you want to remind listeners who he is?
Terry Garcia, and listeners might be very interested in his book, a new book that he's co-authored, The Future of Exploration. Here he is now.
Terry Garcia, I want to talk to you about who owns and tells history. And you've actually been awarded Peru's highest civilian honour for your part in returning some ancient artefacts, which were held at Yale University.
Yes.
And this is a story that comes up from time to time on this program. You know, the reinterpretation.
Future Garcias are probably not going to be able to go to Yale University as a result of that.
You're not welcome on campus.
I was not a popular guy, no.
There's so
well, that's
much.
Disgraceful, by the way, given if you really read it closely.
I'll tell you what happened. This was when I first got to National Geographic. I received a call from a fellow in Peru, a businessman, and he wanted to know why we had the Machu Picchu artifacts. And I said, well, I don't think we do, but let me check. And so I had my staff go and check. And, you know, we had a warehouse of stuff that had been brought back over the years. And they came back and they said, no, we don't have it. But here are all the documents that we did find. And it turned out that we, National Geographic, had made a grant to Hiram Bingham back in 1911. He didn't discover, he rediscovered it for Europeans. It had always been there, and the people in the area knew it had been there. But we had given him a grant. It was a joint expedition with Yale, and received permission at the time to remove some of the objects from Peru for scientific study. Well, there was a time limit on it, and they were meant to be loans. And so we found that out. I went to Yale, met with the general counsel and the head of the museum and said, you know, look, here's what's going on. We've got an idea on how this can be managed. And they said, we're not interested. It's ours. We're not giving it back.
This is a sort of Elgin Marble British Museum moment.
Yes. And the expression, go pound sand, was used. And I said, okay, yeah, look. There's an easy way and a hard way to do this. You can do it the easy way, which is some variation on what we just talked about, where we do a loan of artifacts. Or the hard way, you can pick a fight with somebody that buys ink by the barrel. And if that's what you want to do, then we are going to not let this go. Every chance we get, we are going to be talking about this. We'll raise it with the public. We'll raise it with your alumni. We'll raise it with your students. This is not acceptable. This is the patrimony, the cultural patrimony of a country, and it was of extraordinary significance to the Peruvians.
And it was by agreement.
It wasn't like the Elgin Marbles.
So it was a different setup.
There was an agreement in writing that said, we are loaning this to you, and you have to give it back to us. They were going, well, they had all sorts of reasons why the statute of limitations had expired. The Peruvians can't take care of this stuff because they don't have the proper scientific and academic credentials, which was nonsense. It took 10 years. 10 years. And the only reason it finally was resolved was that I met with the Peruvians. Litigation was now happening in the U.S. I said, I tell you what, this is it's a crapshoot. Maybe we win, maybe we don't. I think you should talk to the Egyptians. I've worked closely with the head of antiquities, a guy named Zahi Hawass. Talk to him about how he has handled relations with countries that have his cultural patrimony and have refused to return it. And so we got together with him, with the Peruvians, and basically came up with a plan to file a lawsuit in Peru, which they did, but the Peruvians went one better. They filed a criminal complaint. We got a criminal complaint. They could have a warrant for President Levin, for several other senior officials at Yale. Shortly afterwards, we got the call that said, okay, We're ready to talk.
You're a lot tougher than you look. That's a marvelous story.
And they gave it back. But I guess the point of the story, though, was really the significance of these objects. This wasn't gold. It wasn't some extraordinary treasure, except that what it represented. And it was, to the people of Peru, it was part of them. It was their identity. And this institution, this respected academic institution, was telling them that they could not have it back, that they had taken their identity and they were not returning it.
We have this issue that crops up from time to time in Australia where Indigenous rock sites mm-hmm. are destroyed. There's a very famous example at the Juukan Gorge where a mining project destroyed through explosion a very important piece of archaeological history. There's been a recent example in New South Wales where renewable energy projects are rolling through the landscape and a rock shelter was destroyed. Even though it had been located, it was part of the whole process. It was included in all of the pre-work that was being done ahead of the rollout, and then they still bulldozed it. How do you think a nation can or should deal with this sort of thing once it's happened?
Well, once it's been destroyed, I mean, it's hard to get it back at that point, but, you know, you've caused damage. You have to find a way to compensate the people who have suffered the loss.
But what about, because, you know, we can hear enthusiasm for exploration, and often the exploration leads to
exploitation. Yes, I understand.
But it often the real dilemma is that it often leads to preservation as well. The famous shield that was encountered, the first real encounter between white British and Aboriginal people down in the south of Sydney, was this amazing shield. And when you see it, it was in the British Museum. I tell you, I saw it. I could hardly speak. I was so overwhelmed. Now, that would not have survived if it was left here.
Yeah.
It went over there. I've always found this very difficult to
deal with. But if we're talking about what's in the oceans or what's in space, now we can all imagine what the people with the money and the power and the influence will do once we discover what's there. You know, it's not just going to be about preservation, is it?
No. And that's why I raised a moment ago the problem of seabed mining, that there is this enormous financial incentive to begin mining the seabed. And we still don't know enough to inform us how we can do this in a way that will not cause significant harm to the environment. And I'd also say, yes, exploration certainly in the past did lead to exploitation. In some cases, it involved the preservation of objects that would have disappeared. But there has been a shift in how people view this, certainly in the scientific and exploration community. And you're also seeing a different attitude in young people who are now coming up in the ranks and are assuming leadership positions. Their view on exploration is very different from sort of the traditional view of finding lost cities, which is a lot of fun. I mean, I don't get me wrong. But they view this now as additionally a way to deal with some of the challenges that are confronting the global community, that exploration is about finding solutions. And that also gives me hope that you've got this new generation that is saying, we know that we can fix some of these problems. We have the scientific know-how. We want to put that to use, and we want to use exploration. We want to use the public platforms that exploration creates to communicate some of this to the public. And you've got, you know, it used to be that many scientists they weren't the best communicators. You didn't want to put them out there in front of the public.
It's still the case with some of them.
Well, with some, yes, it is. But there are concerted efforts, and you know, the Australian Museum and other institutions are doing incredible work in creating science communicators, and We need more of that.
Yeah. Actually, that's a marvellous segue, because the other thing that you've played quite a significant role in is these big public travelling exhibitions. And the Tutankhamun exhibition, The Treasures, I think was seen by 10 million people around the world. So is this part, has this been a conscious aspect of yours to reach out to do this communication job that you're talking about?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you can't explain to people why this is important, why they should care about it, then you're not going to be able to protect it or preserve it. And exhibitions are one way of doing that. It's really a platform for communicating information about a particular topic. Tut was incredible. I mean, it was seen by millions and millions of people. The other good thing about it was that it generated significant resources for the archaeological community in Egypt, for Egyptian scientists, for Egyptian archaeologists. And as part of the agreement, we had built into it that a significant portion of the profits were going back to Egypt. They weren't staying with the promoters. National Geographic, you know, sadly did not make much money on that, for at least for our CFO. But the money went back to support the science, to support a new generation, to help train a new generation of Egyptologists who were Egyptian.
Have you been to the big new museum?
I've been to it. I've been to it when it was first being built. I've watched it. This is a project that took some 20 years.
I'm deeply envious.
It is world class. They have all of the Tutankhamun objects in it now. And, you know, the Tutankhamun exhibition back in the early 2000s was a significant achievement, because the Egyptians had said after the first one in the 70s, never again. We're never allowing that out. And we managed to convince them to tour it, and it toured for almost a decade.
Hello, it's Hamish here with Geraldine Doog, talking to Terry Garcia about what's left to explore and how science can be communicated and supported to help us meet the many challenges of the future. Do you think, when it comes to exploration, the same rules apply for space?
In what respect?
In terms of human exploration of space, do you think we come at it in the same way? Like when we spoke to Professor Brian Cox on this program, he said the thing that's really interesting about space is that you can't do it as individual nations. You have to work. It has to be multilateral. And he actually, you know, is promoting quite an inspiring idea that for all of our kind of earthly conflicts and disagreements, space and its exploration might be something where we rediscover our capacity to work together.
Well, I agree with that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, easier said than done, of course, but yes. But we also need that kind of collaboration here on Earth and with ocean exploration, because, you know, what I mentioned a moment ago about, you know, that vast area that's unexplored, well, most of it is in the areas outside of national jurisdictions. It's the high seas, and it's been sort of the Wild West. There have been negotiations ongoing for years now, and finally we have a high seas treaty that came into force. But it will require international cooperation. These global treaties only work if you've got the parties working together and willing to enforce the terms. But that's an example of where we're going to have a collaborative approach to it. We need countries to, if you're going to create, for example, a marine protected area, which is what the High Seas Treaty has now enabled. It's created the first mechanism, legal mechanism, that would allow you to create a marine protected area on the high seas. That only works if the parties to the agreement are willing to enforce it.
It strikes me that there's a common thread that runs through all forms of exploration, whether past, present, or future, whether it's deep sea or space or finding artifacts. Mm-hmm. Humans' desire or belief that it can kind of overpower nature. Yeah. and physics. Do you think we will, for as long as humans exist, that we'll always be in that wrestle?
I was just for me too, I was listening to you and just being a bit philosophical. Whether you really took the type of people who might take on space, like the Peter Thiels, the new people who think they're the kings of Silicon Valley, they probably do seek domination, don't they? This is what the Pope has been talking about, and he's urging against the notion of domination. I think it's a very challenging idea.
It's a profound question.
It is a deeply profound question. Now,
I agree. Absolutely.
So the very people who might have the money, or, Elon, for goodness sake, are they thinking of themselves as stewards? Because I think you're talking about stewardship.
I don't think the word steward has passed their lips, okay?
Well, how can you evangelize them? You're the sort of person who might.
And to be fair to someone like Elon Musk, when he went into the OpenAI project, it was a more stewardship approach. And his big falling out with Sam Altman is about this precisely, right?
Yes.
That he thinks this tool of AI is so powerful that it should be non-profit, it should be a sort of shared, managed, safeguarded experience. And he's in court. He's fighting.
Well, he lost,
AI
didn't he?
He lost. And I was being somewhat facetious about that.
Not to be on the air defending Elon Musk, but
I'm not going there. I'll let you. You're doing a good job. Keep it up.
But to this profound question of whether humans really do go into exploration with safeguards in mind, with all of humanity, with the universe in mind.
Knowing they have to work within regulation, this is what I'm hearing, because you're very comfortable with regulation, so am I actually.
Yeah.
But a lot of these types of people, I don't know where they are.
No, they're not. In fact, they view it as an annoyance, as just bureaucracy that is interfering with their ability to advance their agenda. And we need to resist that. But again, that's the public have to make that clear to our elected officials. And I'd say one more thing on exploration, if I could. And one of the reasons that it's so important, and it goes back to this notion that every time you go out into the field as an explorer, as any individual, though, you come back changed. Because your perspective has been altered as a result of that experience. And I was giving a talk several months ago and was reading some research material and came across a tract written by this French author back in the 50s. And he was using mountain climbing as an example. And he said, you can't stay at the summit forever. So what's the point? Why even go? And he said, well, the point is that when you're at the summit, you're able to see things that you can't see from below. And when you descend, you carry that with you, that altered perception of what you have seen, back to the community, back into your life, and it stays with you your entire life. And that's why you explore. It's oftentimes the significance, it's not what you found, but how it has impacted you, how it has changed you, and how you see the world, your place in it, and the planet.
Terry Garcia, you've certainly taken us to the summit for a different view with this conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry. It's my pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
And I would say the main headline is that Geraldine likes regulations. the dodgiest parker of cars, I know.
Not that kind of regulation.
I just want to have to live with Terry. Absolute, What is it? Defamation on air.
I tell you, yes.
Terry, thank you very much. It's been wonderful.
Bye-bye. Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
That's Terry Garcia, for many years the Chief Scientist and Exploration Officer for the National Geographic Society. He was in Australia recently to deliver the Talbot Oration, called Our Ocean, Our Lifeline, at the Australian Museum. We'll put a link to that on the website, but also in the show notes.
And Look, in it he reminds us that, and I'm going to quote from him here because he had just so many gorgeous quotes, there is more human history beneath the surface of the ocean than in all the museums on land. It is a speech that's full of the power of positivity, which he just imbues, I must say, but also a clarion call on behalf of our oceans. It was that quinella that was so arresting, I think.
Geraldine, you really liked that story about Yale University and Peru.
I really thought it was something because it was so gutsy of him and he'd paid a personal price and he'd stuck with it 10 years.
But it just even listening to him, watching him deliver that story, it was like a different version of the same person.
Yeah, he got a steel in him.
In the way, you know, and just rattled off all of the things that he responded with when he said, you can do this the easy way or the hard way.
Go away and pound the earth. I mean, they were obviously outrageous. You know, they sent him off. They just sort of said, go away and play, please. And so he was both, that's how I took it, that he was both personally affronted and affronted at their total inability to engage with the scale of what they were involved in. And, you know, when you go back and look at the story, I mean, it was a very definite agreement between the Peruvian government that they would be entitled to use this for scientific review, I think was the phrase, and they just ignored it. And I mean, it was the assumption that we here at Yale know better. I mean, it was pretty incredible story.
He's heading off to Lizard Island and to see the Great Barrier Reef after giving the oration for the Australian Museum. But I think for me, what's been really interesting about this conversation more broadly is that it's sort of a reminder of the fact that we can look at the world through many different prisms and lenses. You know, on this program, we so often look at it through conflict, through geopolitics, through alliances, through fracturing relationships. It's very political. It's a very particular way of viewing the world. And I've really enjoyed just stepping back from that a little bit and being reminded that science, that exploration, that discovery is every bit as interconnected through different races and ethnicities and languages and geographical locations. And maybe that's helpful for us as we consider some of the really big challenges that are confronting us.
I agree. I think also what I got from him was that he was not naive. I sometimes find, you know, over the years, you know, one's interviewed a few people and they have great big dreams and you think you've got no idea what you're dealing with day to day. You're about to have your funding stripped from you and you've got no idea how to deal with it. He does. He's got that overview grasp of the need for institutional support. I really respected that.
And actually, it just reminded me, listening to him, how politicized science is in the United States. So not just running that agency, but also being brought in, you know, by Obama after the Deepwater disaster, that science is absolutely politicized in America, in part because they have different funding models, and not that it's not politicized here in Australia, but I think it's possibly of a different magnitude there.
Yes, I think that's the case, and he's obviously living, you know, he's living amidst a particular, he's clearly very opposed to the Trump administration, but he's also a passionate American. I certainly got that impression.
It's so interesting, though, about the Trump administration, for all the money that they're pulling out, all of the things that they're destroying, there is this sort of supercharging of technological discovery when it comes to AI and space.
Yes, there is. This is one of the great conundrums. This extraordinary, I mean, that is the story of, that's the wonder, dare I say, of the United States of America, you know, as it comes up to this 250th anniversary, that it has this capacity to change the world and yet at the other end of it, decay.
Can be quite contradictory at times.
It certainly can.
global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. We'd love to hear your thoughts about these couple of episodes with Terry Garcia. We really enjoyed the conversation.
We did indeed, and you might like to check out his book, The Future of Exploration, which he co-authored with nature and cultural photographer Chris Ranier and Sir Richard Branson.
Thanks for your company on this episode. Thanks to producers Rob Kelly, Kylie Morris and Shane Anderson. Jerry, until next time.
Bye-bye.
been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.